You know, it's beginning to look a lot like Christmas. And remember, Jesus is the reason for the season. And so there's no better place to shop this Christmas season than at KGOV.com. Go to KGOV.com, click on the store, and take advantage of a special discount on a variety of Bob Enyart products, apologetics, Bible studies, both audio and video, Bob's amazing debates, teachings on the New Testament, the Old Testament, parenting, pro-life resources, and of course, Bob's tremendous resources on science, now throughout the Christmas season at KGOV.com.
Intelligent design and DNA. Scholars can't explain it all away. Get ready to be awed by the handiwork of God. Tune in to Real Science Radio. Turn up the Real Science Radio. Keeping it real.
Greetings to the brightest audience in the country. Welcome to Real Science Radio. I'm Bob Enyart. Fred Williams is on assignment. There is a brand new paper in a peer-reviewed science journal, a journal about proteins, the Journal of Proteome Research. And what's amazing about this paper is that there are co-authors, many co-authors, from medical departments of major universities, from the health sciences departments, like at Harvard and MIT. But this paper is about dinosaurs. In fact, it's about a hadrosaur and whether or not scientists have found blood vessels, actual blood vessels from a dinosaur. So the universities involved in this paper, North Carolina State, the famous Mary Schweitzer is one of the co-authors, University of Illinois, well, the Biomedical Research Institute of Korea's Institute of Science and Technology. So that's biomedical. Then we have the Proteomics Center of Northwestern University. We have over in Boston, the Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center, the Harvard Medical School, the Department of Cancer Biology from the University of Texas. I mean, this is amazing that we have a paper that normally only paleontologists would be the authors. And we have so many PhD experts on what? On biological material, biological tissue. So to help us talk through this and other science news, we've invited onto Real Science Radio one of my favorite science writers. In fact, I think one of the world's leading experts on dinosaur soft tissue and fresh fossils generally, from Dallas, Brian Thomas. Brian, welcome to Real Science Radio.
Boy, it's my pleasure to be with you today.
What a thrill. And your work at ICR, the Institute of Creation Research. Brian, thank you for all you've done. I saw you at the conference this past summer in Dallas, and you and the whole team, you guys are doing a tremendous job pointing out all the scientific evidence that confirms the book of Genesis.
Well, thanks. It's certainly our pleasure, and thank you for what you do, and thanks for taking what we do and making it known, because we are one of the best-kept secrets in the whole church in America, I think.
Well, I think that you might be right, the creation movement generally. And, Brian, when we were together speaking, in fact, one of the themes of the conference this summer was dinosaur soft tissue, and it was just exhilarating to hear all the latest. And now, just this past week, another major paper published on dinosaur soft tissue, and there's something new. I think they broke new ground with this, and that's their terminology. For decades, literally for 20 years, they've been talking about blood vessel-like structures or blood cell-like structures in dinosaur bones. This paper, it's a bit different, no?
It comes right out. They've gone through the scientific mill, and we're confident now that it's actual, just plain old, straightforward blood vessels. Not just like them, but it is them.
Yeah. In fact, in the title of the paper, they come right out and say it. In the conclusion of the paper, they come right out and say it, that these are blood vessels from a dinosaur. So that's thrilling. But could I ask you this, before we get into the soft tissue and fossils, you have a fabulous article in the latest issue of Creation Magazine. Would you mind if we go ahead and talk about your article? I know it's a different subject, but it's rats, bats, and pitcher plants. I love this article, Brian.
Pitcher plants and bats, what in the world do they have to do with one another?
Yeah, right. Because pitcher plants, people might not know what a pitcher plant is. It's like we use in the kitchen to hold juice, right, in a pitcher that you might pour out into a glass. So there
are...
Yeah.
Yeah, but these are plants, and the plant forms a tube with a mouth-like opening, and it's in the tropics, in the jungles of Indonesia and South America, and they're pretty amazing.
And we've long known that these pitcher plants, they collect nutrients because of the way they are shaped, the way they're formed. And that's somewhat understandable that it's like a big bucket, and just like a bucket of water on your back porch might collect insects and leaves and so on. That's what these things do. But now scientists, researchers have figured out this amazing symbiotic relationship that these pitcher plants have with bats, rats and bats. But maybe we could talk specifically about bats. What's going on between the pitcher plants and bats?
Well, bats, as you know, during the day, they roost. So they have to find a place to roost. And it turns out that these pitcher plants in Borneo now, far, far from here, they provide this little home for the bats to make a little roost. And then during that time, the bats are, of course, digesting the food they've eaten in the dawn and dusk. And so they process that food, and it drops down to the bottom of the pitcher.
Like,
and then the plant uses that waste, the bat's waste, it recycles that waste and turns it into more plant.
Like
so it's amazing.
Yeah, we've all heard about bat guano, and this is very high in nitrogen, and it's extremely nutritious for the plant. So somebody might think, especially an evolutionist who believes that everything comes down to random mutations and natural selection, just no foresight, no design, no intention. They might think, well, sure, you know, bats happen to find these plants. They live in the opening there, and they don't get digested. They don't go down deep enough into the pitcher to get digested, thankfully. They just found these plants, and so it just coincidentally, there's a good relationship, just coincidentally.
Isn't that a nice story?
Yeah, it is.
Too bad there's a load of fact that refute that little story. And you have to look at the details to find these facts. And, for example, the reason the bats don't get digested is because the pitcher narrows too tightly, so the bats can't. Even if the bat were to fall down in the pitcher, he wouldn't get digested. He'd be able to climb out because of the diameter shrinks down there.
Yeah.
But here's the amazing thing is how the bats find these pitcher plants in the middle of a dense forested jungle. And it's because the pitcher plants that we're talking about, and it's just these pitcher plants, and it's just these particular species of bats that are tuned. They're tuned to one another. And so the pitcher plant opening has this extension that rises up above it, and it acts like a sonic reflector so that when the bat uses its echolocation system,
right,
it actually sees the reflector, and it just jumps out at it right in the middle of the woods. And
wow,
you can find these pitcher plants really easily because of the specific, detailed structure of these reflectors.
And the researchers who did this work in Borneo, they published in a very prestigious journal, the journal Current Biology of July 2015. And their paper is titled, Bats Are Acoustically Attracted to These Symbiotic Carnivorous Plants. So the acoustic tuning is extraordinary because, and maybe we could describe a little bit of it. On top of the pitcher, there's a lid-like structure. Like we might have a pitcher with a lid. Well, there's a structure up above the opening of the pitcher, and it's just the right shape to make the bat sounds louder as the echoes coming back to that creature.
Right. So we think of the satellite dish or something like that, where the sound gets focused and intensifies. And so it's concave. The curvature of it intensifies the sound. But then on the sides, I mean, what if the bat's not just head-on to this reflector?
Right, right.
Well, the sides of it have little ridges, and the distance between each tiny ridge corresponds to the frequency of the sound wave that this particular bat emits from its mouth. I mean, it's almost as though someone designed both the pitcher plant and the bat with the same design principles in mind, and they used forethought to do this.
And we're talking.
I think that's what happened.
Right, and we're talking about precision engineering.
Correct.
Which we see in example after example when we're in awe at living organisms and how they were designed. But then there's also the hollow tube below the lid-like structure. And it turns out that because it's a hollow tube, it absorbs sound, and that creates a distinct contrast for the bats to recognize. So it's just extremely well-tuned because you're in a jungle. You're in this huge jungle, and these plants, they're just here and there, wherever they happen to be. And you've got some bat coming into the jungle, and it's able to find these plants with great efficiency.
Find it with great efficiency and roosts in it, and the plant keeps pests off, which keeps the bats healthier because they don't have these little pests on them. And so the bats are healthier. Of course, the pitcher plant's healthier because it benefits from the waste. Mm. And so how do you get the DNA to have the blueprint to manufacture these reflectors with just the right ridges and just the right shape of concavity and just the right shape and thickness of the tube, you know, of the pitcher itself? And then how do you engineer DNA to make all these features fit? The only way to do it is literally to engineer it.
Yeah, because it turns out that these are evolutionary scientists who are figuring out, as they study the blueprint of living organisms, that they have a top-down structure. And it's not as though you could take small details of an organism and tweak them and change them a billion times over, and you end up producing another major high-level function. The functions have a top-down design, and that's becoming obvious the more molecular biologists explore the kingdom of life.
It's amazing. It's an amazing time, because the more details we uncover, the more questions we have for the standard sort of natural selection of mutants type of story that we hear. This is a strong challenge, these pitcher plants and the bats. Now, so at the Institute for Creation Research, we talk about the fact of creation, and we like to point out these kinds of things that the secular study authors in this case, they said further studies will be necessary to understand how such complex interactions evolved. In other words, we don't know how this happened.
Well, right.
Because they're ignoring creation. Well, creation's how it happened. At the Institute, we talk about the fact of creation from Genesis, but also the timing of creation. Yes, God did it, but when did he do it? How did he do it? He did it. We find more evidence in other sciences that he did it the way he said he did it, right there in Genesis.
And he did it recently, which is
That's just right. So
thrilling. The authors of that paper in Current Biology, they say that this symbiotic relationship, it's still not sufficiently understood. They always use those words, like it's not completely understood, it's not sufficiently understood how they evolved. And what they normally mean by that is we have no idea how this could evolve. But they use those words. It's a pattern I've observed for decades. They say this is not yet completely understood. And that's what they say when they mean we have no idea how this might happen based on our model.
What we have are clues in nature that natural systems were formed by something outside of nature, because there's nothing within nature that can make these kinds of systems.
Yeah. So Brian Thomas, thank you for that article in the latest Creation Magazine, the latest issue, volume 38, number 1 for 2016, Rats, Bats, and Pitcher Plants by Brian Thomas. So now, if we could, Brian, to work our way into dinosaur soft tissue, dinosaurs are just one category, right? There's actually all kinds of fossils that are supposed to be millions of years old that have original biological material.
That's right. And this gets to the timing of creation, doesn't it? Because if it's supposed to be millions of years old, then these biological materials should have degraded, even locked in rock, because there's no such thing as a hermetic rock. So water, vapor, and oxygen and gases, they permeate throughout the crust of the earth. And so these things are going to decay. And there's no science to support any suggestion other than chemical reactions inevitably occur, and they will degrade these things. Like you said, we've got bird feathers and decayed skin remnants. We even have not very decayed, like mummified skin on some creatures, lizards and
that are supposed to be 2 million years old.
We've got all kinds of stuff.
Right, sure. And we've been collecting a list at Real Science Radio. But Brian, thank you and ICR, because our effort to document all the peer-reviewed papers on dinosaur soft tissue and then other fresh fossils, that effort began with you guys and your original list of fossil analysis with verified original soft tissue. You guys put that out years ago. What a tremendous list of about 40 peer-reviewed papers. And we've taken that and run with it, and we've been building on that ever since.
Well, I appreciate you doing that, and I like laboring with you. And that's what happened was I was working as a science writer here, and I write our news articles that go on our website, icr.org. In fact, we have a news version of the pitcher plants and bats on our website, icr.org. But as I was writing news articles since 2008 to 2011, and even since then, I kept reading these original biomaterials still in fossils papers or in the journals. And so I thought, you know, someone needs to make a list of all these.
Yeah.
And so I started making a list. I frankly ran out of steam in 2011. I said, look, I've stopped after 40. Someone else pick it up, and you guys have done it, so I appreciate you.
Well, you're so welcome. And I've heard from scientists who work at major institutions. I mean, secular, evolutionary institutions. I don't want to name them because I don't want to cause blowback for the scientists, potentially, but who go to our webpage to find the latest on whatever topic they're looking into regarding dinosaur soft tissue. So we've made an impact, I think, and it's because we're standing on the shoulders of giants. Thank you for what you've done. So on your website, icr.org, there is a page, Fresh Fossils. We link to it from our list of dinosaur soft tissue, and it's not just dinosaurs. It's all kinds of fossils that are supposed to be millions of years old that have original material. I'd really love to plug that page, Brian. It's got the most important information available on this topic on the whole web. And at the top of the page, you guys have a short video that highlights what this topic is all about. What would you think if I asked my producer, Larry Wolf, to right now go to that video and so the audience could hear the audio track? Is that all right with you?
Well, if you have the technological wizardry to be able to do that, I am all thumbs up.
Okay, yeah, because it's so well done and it's so fun. So, yeah, Larry has it. I can see it. It's on his screen there. He's our board operator today. So, yeah, let's listen to this.
This is one of our That's a Fact videos.
Walk into any natural history museum and you're likely to see an enormous T-Rex skeleton staring you in the face. Of course, unlike Hollywood movies like Jurassic Park, the dinosaurs we see today are just fossils. Paleontologists dig up all kinds of fossils, mostly just small bones or seashells. But occasionally, they discover unusual fossils, like squid with ink, lizards with skin, or even a T-Rex with blood. That's what scientists uncovered in Montana in 1990. Bones with soft blood vessels inside. And when they examined the blood vessels in the lab, they found dinosaur blood cells. Other discoveries around the world include fossils with hair, feathers, and even skin, which makes a paleontologist scratch his head because things like skin and blood can only last thousands of years. And what about that squid fossil? In 2009, scientists found a dried ink sac inside. When they made the ink wet, they were actually able to write with it. A lot of scientists insist that dinosaur fossils are many millions of years old. But the facts of science tell a different story, that squid with ink and lizards with skin and dinosaurs with gooey blood vessels can only have been buried a short time, which is exactly what the Bible has said all along. Because God created all living things, including man, just a few thousand years ago, even that enormous T-Rex at the museum.
Wow, too fun. Hey, Brian, you produce so many fabulous video resources, but you guys have a number of That's a Fact videos, right?
There's several dozen on all different topics. And
yeah,
we like to make those because they crawl around the web easily and they make one point, it's fun to watch, and you get the point. And
yeah,
I like the phrasing there, gooey blood vessels in the T-Rex.
Well, gooey blood vessels, maybe that'll bring us to this paper in the Journal of Proteome Research. And I mentioned before the conclusion, and I know we want to talk about the paper itself, but let me jump to the conclusion for a second, because they say this, just a few quotes out of this. Confident identification of protein sequences from, and they're talking about from a dinosaur. Now, they always say a Brachylophosaurus canadensis. Did I pronounce that right? Do you have any idea, Brian?
That sounds good to me. I just call it a duckbill.
A duckbill, and it's a hadrosaur. So they're saying they have confident identification of protein sequences from this duckbill dinosaur. And then this, confirming the presence of these proteins on the dinosaur vessels. They've gone beyond just saying these are blood vessel-like or dinosaur protein-like. Here they say the peptides detected from hadrosaur blood vessels are endogenous, and they're not from bacteria or fungus. So that word endogenous, what does that mean?
It's from the animal that died. In this case, it arose from the dinosaur's bone itself. It didn't come in later on from microbes like fungus, or some authors have suggested, hey, you can't be looking at original endogenous dinosaur blood vessels, because that would be long gone millions of years ago.
Right.
You must be looking at some kind of other gooey, soft structure that bacteria have created in the little spaces and holes inside the dinosaur bone that look like blood vessels.
Right.
And so what they've done here is they've gone and sequenced the proteins, and the protein sequences match those proteins that make up blood vessels. And none of those proteins are made by bacteria or fungus. It's really amazing work.
So that's why they're saying that they're confirming the presence of dinosaur proteins. And they're confirming it. And this is not contamination from bacteria. And one last quote from the conclusion, they speak of the identification of these still soft, hollow blood vessels produced by the once living dinosaur. I mean, that's about as clear as you can put it. And in a way, they've just come out of the closet with this now. They are saying flat out, we have original dinosaur biological tissue. That's thrilling.
Yeah, it's definitely black and white now.
So, Brian, as their paper opens up, they say, you know, in the past, there was analysis of collagen from a T-Rex, and they said that was controversial, and that's putting it mildly, right? Mary Schweitzer was hated by the paleontology community from my perspective. I mean, the vicious things they said about her, what a fool she was, and how absurd, and how her work is completely naive and not believable. But she said it was controversial because they had a hard time believing that proteins could survive from the Cretaceous period. Now,
right.
Not everybody remembers how long ago that's supposed to be, but that's tens of millions of years ago, the Cretaceous period.
Sure, yeah, it supposedly ended 65.5 million years ago, and she's got Upper Cretaceous, or they would call Late Cretaceous.
Well,
so that's like 70 million years, but, you know, give me a break. This stuff, we have the decay rates measured in the lab, and it was the archaeologist mostly who looked at that original research that she had published and said, this stuff, we've been studying this in archaeology for decades. We know how fast collagen decays, and it can't last 1 million years, let alone 70 million. So you're off your rocker, you know, and that's kind of the feedback that she got.
And the archaeologists, the reason they would study the decay rate of collagen in the lab is because they had mummies, they had
right.
artifacts from campsites, from graveyards of Egyptians who built the pyramids. And so they have some pretty good historical idea, I mean, at least within a century or two, of when these, in that case, human beings lived, and now they have their bones. And so they look in their bones and they could see remnants of collagen and remnants of biological structures. But of course, it's mostly decomposed, but there's still some. Because there's still some, they wanted to know, well, how long does it take this stuff to decompose? And we have hard numbers from the lab, and maybe you could help me understand some of that. I mean, they literally have half-lives of these different biological compounds.
That's right. They do have half-lives, although it doesn't decay at as regular a pace as something like a radioactive element or nuclear decay or anything like that. But
sure.
But we can put ranges on it, you know. So at the outermost range, the half-life of collagen, bone collagen protein, on the very outside, a maximum shelf life would end up being something like 900,000 years, something on that order. And that's with optimum burial conditions that they simulate in the lab.
And so when you have these studies, and in fact you have the world filled with the remnants of animals and humans that died in historical time frame, and we could study those, that's like a worldwide laboratory. And what we see from these fossils of organisms that were alleged to live millions and tens of millions of years ago, and some fresh fossils go back hundreds of millions of years, we find similar kinds of decomposition in the fossils as we do in the remains of organisms from known historical timeframes. Similar, not exact.
That's right. It's similar in the degree to which it has decayed. In some cases, they're similar. It's surprisingly similar. And I think that the surprise comes from our belief that it's really millions and hundreds of millions of years old. Now, if you erase that crazy time scale, and if we just understand the fossils and rock layers as having been formed during Noah's flood and only thousands of years ago, that means this whole entire stack of rocks, you know, the pancake layers and all the fossils that they contained, they were all, you know, most of them deposited just in 1 year and only thousands of years ago. And so we would expect to find, therefore, the same kinds of things that we are finding, which is the same degree of degradation in both archaeological and fossil remains in a lot of cases.
So, Brian, to go on from Mary first in her paper, well, it's actually, she's not the lead author this time. It's Timothy Cleland. But to go on in their introduction, they said, you know, long time ago we found collagen in a T-Rex. And then they talk about the discovery they made from a hadrosaur, a duck-billed dinosaur. And they said it was controversial, you know, and with all the science and all the papers published, they write that still there was skepticism, continued skepticism. And they point out a recent paper, and that was from this summer. And this is so fun because it's in the journal Nature Communication. And it comes from Bones from the British Museum of Natural History. And I went there it was in September, Brian. I went to the British Museum, their Museum of Natural History. I spoke to their science staff at the Museum of Natural History because they opened a drawer down in their collections. They have millions of specimens, millions. And they opened a drawer of very nondescript dinosaur bones, and they took 8 of them. And they thought, well, these don't look like they have any kind of special preservation. Let's cut these open and use an electron microscope and other techniques. Let's see if there's soft tissue in these. They really were sure they weren't going to find anything. They found blood cells, many blood cells. I mean, basically blood and other biological material in 6 of the 8 bones. 6 of the 8. And so this current paper says, well, that's actually given us a renewed interest in this whole field. Yeah, I guess so.
Right. It's probably nice for Mary Schweitzer, who's not the lead author, but the senior author of this Journal of Proteome Research paper that we're talking about, for her to not have to take the hit, you know, on that one. These authors of the paper you're talking about, Nature Communications, with the British Museum bones, and they had been sitting in those drawers for a century, Bob.
Right.
And they're just sitting there with the original, you know, dried down. It's not like they're
it wasn't in a climate.
Until you rehydrate them.
Oh,
but,
no, right. Dehydrated.
But it surely does renew interest.
Yeah, absolutely. So then in this paper, could you tell us a little bit about what they found? Now, on our website at realscienceradio.com, we have a list of dinosaur soft tissue papers, and we do list all the journals that have been publishing, like Nature and Science and PNAS and Plus One and Proceedings of the Royal Society, Bone, and so on. But then we list all the biological material found, and this is from fossils from dinosaur layer and deeper strata. And they have so far discovered flexible and transparent blood vessels, red blood cells, many various proteins, including ones they've sequenced, maybe not in total, but significantly, microtubule building block protein called tubulin, collagen, part of the cytoskeleton of a cell, actin, hemoglobin. They have osteocyte cells. They have pigment melanosomes that make the color of your skin or the color of Archaeopteryx feathers. They have the DNA-related histone proteins that DNA is wrapped around. They have found a lot of stuff from dinosaurs. And so in this paper, Brian, could you help us understand what they found from this particular hadrosaur?
Well, they used at least two different techniques. One is the standard and reliable immunological stain technique. Basically, you apply a chemical to the sample and it lights up if the protein is there. And so they found using that method, a tubulin, actin, myosin, and a protein called tropomyosin. Now, these are not made by bacteria, and that's their point, is these have to come from some vertebrate, and it comes from within the blood vessels themselves because they light up along the exact same pattern of where the blood vessel physically is. Hmm. Does that make any sense?
Well, it does, because when an organism dies, and let's say its skeleton begins to decompose, dries out, you could get bacteria to invade, of course. That happens. But you're not going to get another vertebrate animal to invade the bone of a dinosaur. And that other vertebrate animal is not going to grow new blood vessels inside that old bone.
Yeah, that's exactly right. It's not going to grow blood vessels in the exact same positions and shapes as the dinosaur blood vessels were.
Right.
And that's what they're finding here. They also used mass spectrometry and to sequence these. This is the acid test, so to speak, for whether or not you've got protein and exactly what protein it is, because it gives you the sequence of amino acids that make up that protein. Mm. So they sequenced histones, like you said. It's found in the DNA carrying nucleus of some of these cells. They found actin and beta tubulin. And so these are proteins that vertebrates make. These are proteins involved in structures like skin and muscle, and bacteria, fungus don't make skin or muscle, so they don't have these proteins. But yet they're finding it and verifying that those proteins in this duck-billed dinosaur, it's amazing. It just should not be there, you know,
right,
if it's as old as the standard story suggests.
Right, exactly. And these histone proteins, your article that we mentioned earlier, published in Creation Magazine, one of the scientists there, Dr. Jonathan Sarfati, brilliant. He's been published in the journal Nature. I emailed him a question about a paper about a year and a half ago, and he emailed me back. He said, Bob, so far they've used three tests to identify DNA within biological material from dinosaurs, and they've got positive results from three different DNA tests that they do have DNA from a T-Rex and a hadrosaur. Now, it's not sequenced, so it's decomposed, and it's, so far as we know, no researcher has been able to sequence the DNA. But when you said that they have histone proteins here, those are the proteins that DNA wraps around. Is that correct?
That's right. Yeah. So if you have histone proteins, you may still have intact nucleus inside of a cell.
Right.
Which they visualized that in other publications and other dinosaur bone tissues. So if you've got histone, then you may have some DNA still wrapped around it.
Well, and molecular biologist Kevin Anderson, I know that you know Kevin, he spoke at the conference this past summer in Dallas that was hosted by ICR. Thank you for doing that. He co-authored a paper in a very prestigious journal, Acta Histochemica, and they have cells from the horn of a triceratops. And they photographed these cells, and you can see these beautiful osteocyte bone maintenance cells. And inside the cell, you could see the nucleus. And
that's
right. So when Mary Schweitzer and others published on evidence for dinosaur DNA, they're looking inside the cell, inside the nucleus that's still visible, and in the right place, they're getting histone proteins being sequenced and multiple tests showing positive results for the double helix for DNA. So that's another aspect of this whole field that's going to come to fruition, I think. They're going to start, I mean, it'll be hard, but they're probably going to start sequencing small bits of dinosaur DNA. At least I'm hopeful.
Well, they may. It's difficult to get published because prior publications have resulted in major backlash from the scientific community.
Well,
not because it's bad science, but because of the millions of years that they're married to.
Yeah, right. I mean, we have half-life of DNA, just like we have half-life of amino acids being racemized back to a 50-50 state from within proteins. Amino acids are all left-handed. We don't have to get into that. But just recently, in the past few years, a leading journal published a lab-tested half-life of DNA being about 520 years. And so you do the math and you realize there should not be a double helix positive result from a test from any dinosaur material. I mean, that's just absurd if they're millions of years old. But if they're only thousands of years old, then, of course, the results are somewhat, they're still astounding, but they're somewhat expected.
Well, they are expected given the measured decay rates on that study, 521 years of half-life for the control region of mitochondrial DNA. Mm. That's what they studied on that paper. So based on that half-life, we can sort of extrapolate that out and go, well, given a certain temperature, because these decay rates for proteins, DNAs, any biological molecule, they're temperature dependent. And the hotter it is, what does it do, Bob?
Well, the hotter it is, the quicker it's going to decompose.
The faster it decays. That's right.
Yeah.
And so you've got to have these DNA sources be in cold regions for a long, long time. And given that, you know, you can have them last for thousands of years, but to make it cold enough to last for a million years, you know, you have to have the Earth as a ball of liquid nitrogen or something.
Right, exactly. And so, Brian, the evidence is so overwhelming. Maybe one last science point. It's slightly off topic, but these histone proteins, it is so interesting to me. When scientists look at histone proteins and they look at it from the plant kingdom, I mean, they sequence a protein, let's say green peas. That green pea DNA is wrapped around histone proteins. And then you get the same thing with mammals. And they look at it, and this has been published by Michael Behe back 25 years ago, but they look at it and they're almost identical. Yet evolutionists would say, so when did the plant kingdom split off from an animal kingdom? It'd be hundreds of millions of years ago. And so there is this stunning similarity. They said that in 102 positions on the DNA of a histone protein, there was a difference in only two of them between green peas and mammals. And so then they began in the lab to mutate the histone protein. And they found out that it's very fault tolerant. It's very robust. They could mutate it and it still works. It still works. That would suggest that plants and mammals have a very recent common origin. The fact that their histone proteins are almost identical.
Well, it suggests that to someone who assumes that they did have a common origin. In other words, you assuming evolution.
Well, if you
then,
right,
if then it would look. But the thing is with DNA, and we're getting a little bit off my field,
yeah.
But with these DNA sequences and other biological polymer sequences, it's willy-nilly. It follows no evolutionary pattern. Mm-hmm. Sometimes you get a gene that's almost identical, like you're saying, between completely unrelated different species. And other times you get completely unique genes in different species, but you don't find, you know, transitioning genes or anything like that. It's like each kind, each plant or animal or whatever kind it is, has its own suite of genes that are uniquely tailored for that creature to do exactly what it does, grow the way it does. It really shows evidence of supreme, divine, supernatural engineering down to the minutest detail.
Well, when you have whale DNA and bat DNA sharing virtually identical, astounding sequences for echolocation, and the evolutionists admit that bats did not evolve from whales, or vice versa. They admit that they have no common ancestor that had echolocation. And yet, the evolutionists who published these papers expressed their shock and dismay that how could it turn out to be virtually identical? And you've got elephant shrews. Their DNA is closer to an elephant than to other shrews, you know, other little rodents. Everywhere they look, they're stunned because the genetic sequencing is contradicting Darwin's theory of evolution. And that is virtually everywhere they look. It's so much fun, Brian. Thank you for being willing to go off topic a bit here and there. I appreciate that.
Well, it is fun to share this time with you. It's the reason it's fun and exciting right now, Bob, I think you and I agree, is that the discoveries in genetics, the discoveries in the fossils, the discoveries in living organisms, all these things we've been talking about, they confirm over and over again the history that's in Genesis. The fact of creation and the timing of creation and the way, the means of creation, God's powerful spoken word, it's all confirmed so that we should be without excuse, you know, for failing to recognize and give credit to God, our great creator, the Lord Jesus Christ, for doing all these things and doing it just the way he said in Genesis. And of course, if Genesis got it right, then every other book of the Bible that leans on Genesis or refers back to Genesis,
well, you could
trusted too.
Yes, you can trust the scriptures because they're inspired by God, by the Holy Spirit, so that we would not be lost and in darkness, but we could have a light that guides our way. And that is just as true wherever the Bible touches on history or language or science, creation. You can trust that Jesus Christ affirmed the global flood of Genesis in the time of Noah and the creation account, as do the authors through the New Testament. We can trust God's word, and thank you, Brian Thomas, for your work at ICR, the Institute of Creation Research. You might be the nation's best-kept secret, Brian, but I know that hundreds of thousands of people are being encouraged by the work you're doing. Thank you for that.
Well, that's great. I appreciate it. Thanks for having me on, Bob.
You're very welcome. Looking forward to the next show when we have a scientist from ICR, the Institute for Creation Research, one of the great creation ministries that were established, founded by Henry Morris, Dr. Henry Morris, who is a hero to the creation movement, the modern creation movement. So that's this episode of Real Science Radio. Fred Williams has been on assignment. Lord willing, we'll have Fred back in studio real soon. And please consider to shop in our store. Browse. At the top of our website, you can click on store. Then go to the science department. We have fabulous books and videos, debates. You'll just love it. It all has a 30-day money-back guarantee. You could subscribe to our monthly services, get Bible studies and topical DVDs. I really think you'll love it, and you'll help us to stay on the air with Real Science Radio. Until the next episode, this is Bob Enyart for Fred Williams and Real Science Radio. May God bless you.
Intelligent design and DNA. Scholars can't explain it all away. Get ready to be awed by the handiwork of God. Tune in to Real Science Radio. Turn up the Real Science Radio. Keeping it real. That's what I'm talking about.